The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
Welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I am Brian Mitchell, and I am, as always, your host. Well, last week on part one of the Robert Alvarez interview, he was talking about his young life where he was doing a bit of dumpster diving at some of the animation studios in Hollywood and pulling out these works of art that he would collect over the years, and he still has a lot of that material. I think we kind of wrapped up. We're talking about the what are cartoon shorts that were done for Cartoon Network. So we're going to pick up from there. If you've noticed, we now have a brand new Cartoonerific show, and it is separate from the podcast. It is Cartoonerific News. And it's hosted by a popular guest, Marjorie Stewart. She'll be doing these every Tuesday night. They'll be uploaded. And the first show is up now. It's relatively short, has some news, and then basically next week on the podcast, or every Tuesday now, we'll have Cartoonerific News, and it will grow in length. But it will be covering all different things that are animation related, upcoming events, new releases, all this wonderful stuff, little bits and pieces here and there. And so Marjorie will be reporting on that. Like I said, every Tuesday, a brand new episode will be uploaded. And the reason why I wanted to separate this from the podcast, it's very simple. A lot of the stuff is dated. So, you know, you might be listening to Cartoonerific News from a show we did 2 years ago, and it's quite obviously old news. So we wanted to have a separate podcast that basically would give you the news, and it wouldn't affect the actual Cartoonerific podcast. So there you go. So Cartoonerific News, every Tuesday, Marjorie Stewart, who did a wonderful job with the first one. They're going to get better and better. Please check into that every Tuesday. Anyway, we'll be back with Robert Alvarez Part 2 coming up right after this. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons, with your host animator, Brian Mitchell. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
Well, like I said, here is part two with Mr. Robert Alvarez. Please sit back and enjoy. Were the storyboards tight or were they very loose? Or was it a combination?
Well, like on my boards, they were tight in the sense that even after I pitched it, I went back through the boards. And when I was slugging the boards and directing them, I put in more poses. So right. I would have poses on the top and down below, and you know, and that all was got incorporated into the layouts.
Sure.
And Pat Ventura would do the same. And his were really well posed out. Some of the guys were pretty novice, so they didn't know how to do that. So they couldn't do that stuff.
Right.
But on mine and Pat's, they were really posed out. And you know, like Gindy's, his Dexter stuff was well directed because he's a great animator, and he also directed McCracken's two Powerpuff shorts. So that stuff probably, I don't recall the storyboards on those, but they probably were really well posed out.
Yeah.
And it just depended on who was doing what.
I just remember I worked on something which was these Slimer cartoons. I was freelancing on them. And they were very loose, but the storyboards were tight enough they could actually blow them up and just put them on animation paper, and basically that would be your layout. and then you could just animate it, you know.
Yeah, Hanna-Barbera did that with the Flintstone Kids show. Mm-hmm. In fact, my wife worked on that. They were cleaning up the storyboards so that they could blow them up for layouts purposes. And yeah, some places did that. Yeah, like nowadays, I know this happens a lot where people will say, like, you know, they want the storyboards to be on model. And I always think, why? That's mm-hmm. what model sheets are for.
Right.
You just have to be close because, you know, if you have a, if the board is really explains what you want, your model sheets will tell them how to draw the stuff. You don't have to be on model for the storyboard.
No. No, they should be kind of loose. They should be loose and they should be fun. Storyboard should be, you should get the acting, you should get the general layout of the space, but it's just basically for the acting. And then the animator can come in and just use the materials that are provided to. And I mean, look, the stuff goes overseas.
Yeah.
It's crazy sometimes what you get back because you got people overseas that is just saying, you know, stick to the model sheets, and it kind of tightens things up too, you know, kind of changes. If you have some, you know, like extreme poses, you know, it's going to be pulled back somewhat. So, you know, I agree with some of that. I don't know if it's in the case of like the Bakshi stuff where it was always off model. They laid it out and then basically they told them, use the layout, character drawings. And they weren't afraid to go off model on that stuff. So, but
I think, it's a completely different world now. But if you look at the first and second season of the Flintstones, there's a classic example of how you can do something and not stay on model. Because mm-hmm. the stuff would change from scene to scene depending on who animated what. But you know who the characters were.
Sure.
And it works. And you accept it and it looks good. And the other classic example of that is, look at Jay Ward's stuff done in Mexico. Like
right.
In the Rocky and Bullwinkle stuff. That stuff changed all the time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Now it's gone completely the other way where, you know, shows have to be perfect. And everything has to be drawn perfectly and everything has to be on model. And it's actually, I think it's a waste of time. And I tell people, I would tell them all the time this, mm-hmm. the audience will accept anything you give them. So you don't have to go crazy with this stuff, but it's a different world now.
Yeah. I used to look at all the Hanna-Barbera artwork from like the 60s and think that, oh, wow, this stuff is like really well drawn. Until you actually look at the individual cells and then you start realizing, well, wasn't really all that well drawn. You know, the posing is decent, but the, you know, there's something about taking this stuff and you put it on TV because the stuff is only watching it for maybe 3 seconds, 5 seconds. So you're just getting the gist of it. It's not like you're really studying a piece of art.
Yeah, everything, when it comes to animation, everything is point of view. It's like whatever you like. You might like one thing and somebody else will say, I hate that. You know, it's point of view. It's if you like it, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks.
Yeah, it's true. Would you count like some of that, what a cartoon stuff, would you consider that some of the most fun things of your career or?
I enjoyed working on those. I worked on more of the What a Cartoon because there was 48 of them than anybody else because I did a lot of work on the shorts that young guys that came into the studio hadn't, they didn't know anything about directing. So I would get assigned their short to direct it at least.
Right. Wow.
So I worked on a lot of those. And I liked it because it was different. It wasn't like the stuff that we've been doing formulaic stuff prior to this. It was completely different. We were doing new things. We were doing layouts on shows that were not done the way they used to be done. And a lot of the stuff, what happened to be funny, which was something that hadn't been done there in a long time, because a lot of stuff prior to, in my opinion, was not funny. So I like What a Cartoon shorts and had a good time working on that stuff. And and that carried through, you know, after What a Cartoon, when they went to series, because then I worked on Dexter's, and I worked on Powerpuff, and I worked on Cow and Chicken, and you know, when we moved into Cartoon Network Studios in Burbank, I was still working on with those same people on those shows and new shows that they came up with. So I liked it. I liked it a lot. It was all because of the changes that were made in the early 90s.
What capacity were you doing animation direction there on that stuff, or were you doing sheet timing? Or?
Well, what I was doing was like for, say, Dexter's. I was a director on Dexter's for a while, and I was also director on Cow and Chicken and some Powerpuff. You would get a board and the soundtrack, and this is the old days now.
Right.
You get a cassette
the old days.
Soundtrack.
It's not that long ago.
Yeah, you'd get a cassette soundtrack, and you'd get a copy of the recorded script that had the line lengths. It would tell you exactly to the frame how long those lines were.
Right.
So, and then it'll also give you a total for the normal pause. So you knew where you stood as far as the track goes. If it was, I got to the point where I could look at the normal pause total, and if I knew what the format of the show was, say, okay, we're fine, or we're long before I even start.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was basically just slugging boards. Eventually just became slugging boards and writing sheets on shows. And that's after the mid-90s. That's all I did. I didn't do any more animation at all. It was just slugging boards, writing sheets. And eventually, with the digital world, they eliminated slugging boards, because then the animatic became the so-called slug board,
right?
Which, in my opinion, is bad, because that's animatics are a false sense of timing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like you had to consider the animatic as your slug board, and it was then your job to make that work. When I worked for Ray, you know who Ray Patterson was?
Yes.
Okay, I worked for Ray Patterson, and he's what have taught me directing. And he used to tell me two things. One thing he would say, your job is to make that board work. And the other thing he would always say when you were leaving his office, he would always say this, keep smiling. Every time you left his office, he always said that to you. And when it came to the digital age with animatics,
right,
that became your job is to make the board work now. And what would happen would be, well, if you didn't have enough footage or if it was too much, you still had to make it work, because some showrunner sat down with an animatic editor and go, you know, more or less. And you had to do what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And then when the film, you know, the show would come back and they go, oh, that's too fast. Well, come here, Sparky. Who's the one that decided that that's how much time you wanted? It was you. Mm-hmm. And you have to explain to him, it's not my fault, it's your fault.
Right.
If you want me to change things, then let me change things if I think it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But so the digital world changed all that, so there was no more slugging.
Right.
But I'll tell you who still does slugging.
Who?
Gendy.
Wow.
Because you know his show Primal?
Right.
He took me, I was in his, he, when I was still at Cartoon Network, his office was like right around the corner from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into his office one day and he showed me a slug board. And the only difference thing he did was, instead of doing the boards from like left to right, he was doing like Japanese, top to bottom, the panels.
Right.
But on the right, he was doing it just like he used to do all his other shows when he was doing TV. He slugged them. He was writing out all the action to the frame, because most of that stuff is no dialogue.
Right.
And he was slugging them out. Traditionally, he was not doing animatics because he doesn't need to do it. He knows what he's doing.
Right.
So he's the one guy that still will slug a board. But everybody else, it's animatic, and you have to make the animatics work.
And you got to make them look perfect, right?
That's not. It's impossible, because there's always going to be retakes. I worked on one of the last shows I worked on for Cartoon Network as a spinoff show of Adventure Time called Fiona and Cake, and it's, I know it's aired by now, and I would get retake notes from the showrunner saying, yeah, the timing on this is kind of wonky. He would use that term, wonky, like meaning it was not fast or slow. And I'm going, who's the one that cut the animatic and decided how long they wanted that panel to be on? You.
Mr. Wonky.
I would really get angry, because it was like, I'm trying to make your timing work. And it's all because they don't know what it's the old story. They don't know what they want till they see it.
Right.
And you have people that are not animators and making these decisions and have never really directed anything the old fashioned way. So they don't know until they see it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what goes on a lot nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember a story that I guess it was Joe Barbera told, where when they were dealing with the toy companies for these shows, and he said, yeah, apparently they can cut and they can write and they can do all these different things until the stuff comes back and it doesn't work, you know, and then they have to kind of step in and fix it.
He was a good salesman. I'll tell you a Joe Barbera story, because he used to originally go back to New York to pitch all the shows. And I don't know what show he's pitching. He was pitching a show. And one of the characters was, let's say it was a horse. And he pitches and gets through, and whoever's pitched to said, does it have to be a horse? And Joe, without skipping a beat, he said, did I say horse? I meant dog. And, you know, he just immediately switched, because he's, you know, he was a good salesman. He realized, okay, these people don't want a horse. They want something else.
Right.
So he was, in his day, he was good. But in later years, you know, he got older and he also had health issues and all that.
Sure.
And he wasn't as sharp, and nor was Bill, because Bill towards the end had Alzheimer's, and he eventually died of cancer, but he totally was not sharp towards the end, but he was really nice and pleasant, which is weird for an Alzheimer's patient.
Right.
Because in younger days, he was really rough.
Yeah. I know that. I remember sitting in his office, and this was, I was going to work on the Jetsons movie, and I got fired. And I got fired because I made Rosie the Robot actually move like a robot. And I did this wonderful animation, and he looked at it, and I could swear that his toupee flipped off, if he had a toupee. I don't think he did. But I'm just goofing around. Anyway, he just kept saying, she moves too much. She moves. He just kept saying it over and over and over and over again.
He was already in the beginning stages of his illness.
Yeah.
At that period. Because I worked with him on the feature, because he called me up to come and work in the studio on the feature with him, because I would have to sit in the editing room with him, and he would look at dailies.
Yeah.
And then I would have to take notes, and he said, okay, on this scene, I want you to change blah, blah, blah. And I'd have to make the changes that he wanted.
Right.
And he was nice to me. He was pleasant. But the guy, did you work with Dave Michener at all?
Yes, I did.
He was really pleasant and nice.
Yeah.
And
Dave was great.
Easy to get along with.
Yeah. Dave was great. I showed it to Dave, and Dave was like, yeah, looks good. You know, I kind of remember how he sounded, but he was like, oh, it looks good, you know? And he said, yeah, we should show it to Bill, you know? And then Bill flipped out.
I think Dave just basically took that job because it was an easy cush job for him to do, and he'd take the money and run, because then he soon after retired.
Yeah.
But because he was out of Disney at that point.
Right. He just worked on the Great Mouse Detective, and yeah.
Yeah, I liked Dave. He was a nice man, and I got along fine with him. Mm-hmm. And I got along with Hannah on the Jetson feature.
Right.
Because at that point, he was no longer the young, rough Bill Hannah. He was really pleasant.
Yeah.
To me, he was.
Right.
And, everybody
I just want to say this, because, yeah, he was, he was a little bit rough when he was saying that. And he was just like, he wanted it, just wanted it to be like the television show. He didn't have any patience. But then he turned to me and he said, look, son, I was like, I don't know. I just got married. And he just turned to me and he said, look, son, you know, yeah, it's not going to work out. You know, maybe on something else next time, you know. And so it wasn't terrible. It wasn't terrible. But I say, yeah, it's kind of funny to me, because right after that, I was hired by Sullivan Bluth to animate. They hired me as an animator. So,
yeah, you know, in his, I'll give you an example of his earlier times, because like when we were doing the Smurfs, he was different. That was his old self. Mm-hmm. And we had a meeting one day. All the animators had to attend this meeting. It was after lunch. And he shows up to it late. Mm-hmm. And he started bitching at us for doing too much work. In those days, you had to do 60 feet of animation on the Smurfs a week to justify your pay.
Right.
And you could do 10 feet of bonus. And you get bonus money, whatever it was per foot for that.
Right.
So he said to us, "You guys are working too much. You guys are doing too much animation. I know it's blah, blah, it's crap." He was just yelling at us for doing too much animation. and Jay Sobry was the guy that handed out all the work to the animators. So like he was the head of animation.
Right.
And he turns to Jay in this conference room where we're all sitting at the tables. And he says, "These guys are doing too much work. Isn't that right, Jay?" And Jay, like the loyal lieutenant he was, starts naming names of people that were doing more than there's a footage that they're supposed to be doing. I'm looking at him like, this guy's like,
they're insane.
He's ratting people out. And one guy, I don't know if you ever knew Rudy Cataldi. Rudy Cataldi was an animator who had started at Disney in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't going to take this shit.
Right.
So he stood up to Bill about, the work and all that stuff. He was the only one that challenged him on it. But the funny thing about it was in those days, they had subcontractors in town. There was at least four of them. And I was doing work for three of them. So I was doing way more than 60 feet of animation on the Smurfs.
Sure.
Because that was the old days when you work maybe 6 months, you'd be off. So it was all about trying to make as much money as you can for when you're not working.
Sure. Yeah. I know in the 60s, I guess the late 50s and the 60s, when Bill and Joe were hiring all these animators that are coming off at Disney and, even Lance or Warner Brothers, whatever, they're just hiring up these people. A lot of these people are freelancing at home and they were getting paid per foot. So they were just churning out whatever they could. And they were making a fortune, supposedly.
Well, they were making good money for the time. They weren't making, It's all relative, like if they were making $300 or $400 a week,
right?
Back then, that would have been a lot of money.
Yes,
considering what everybody else might make. And he was picking up guys that were laid off from Disney that may have only been assistants, or even some of them were animators that got laid off at Disney,
right?
And he knew that they were talented. And I heard a story recently where, because when they first opened up their business, they opened up in the Chaplin Studios over on La Brea.
Right.
And across the street was Playhouse Pictures. And he would get out on the street and yell out to the people coming out of Playhouse that he knew, say, "Hey, come on over and pick up freelance." And they'd cross the street and go over to his office and pick up freelance.
Right.
So a lot of people that got laid off from Disney in the early 60s wound up working for Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
It was very common.
Yeah. Well, they're just picking them up. Yeah. What happened after you're working on What a Cartoon on that series, and then you went on to some of the other stuff? Is there anything that stands out, like in the 2000s? Because you're working up until a couple of years ago, right?
Well, I finished my last time I worked was last August. That's when I officially stopped.
Right.
But when we moved into the new building, Cartoon Network, temporarily when we were at Hanna-Barbera, I think it was in around 98 or so, or 97, Turner merged with Time Warner.
Mm-hmm.
So then Warner Brothers became king, they were in charge of everything.
Right.
So they decided they were going to sell the property at Hanna-Barbera, and we got moved over to the facility, Warner Brothers Studio in Sherman Oaks.
Right.
And I was there for 3 years. And then the powers that be, I don't know how they did it, Mike Lasso, I was one of them, convinced Turner to let them open up their own studio, separate from Warner Brothers. And that was the best thing that ever happened. And that's when they, in 2000, they opened up the facility in Burbank. And we moved in there. And I worked on shows that I really liked. And my favorite was Samurai Jack. Because I worked on that with Gendy.
Right.
And I worked on some of his other, I worked on Star Wars, Clone Wars with him, and another show that I can't remember the title, another show of his that was done there. And I also did Powerpuff, more Powerpuff Girls there, more Dexter's Lab there. I also worked on, when they revived Johnny Bravo, I did more work on Johnny Bravo there.
Wow.
And then, you know, I started working on other shows that were being produced there.
Right.
And I think I really enjoyed it. I had a good time. It was a fun place. It was, it had the same atmosphere as we had when we were at Hanna-Barbera. You know, they weren't really strict. You know, they weren't punching the clock, and they didn't care what time you went in or you left, as long as you got your work done.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was a really fun place to be.
Yeah.
And it eventually changed, and probably, well, now it's before the pandemic, maybe a year or two before the pandemic, you could already see the changes were happening. And then once the pandemic hit, they basically kicked everybody else. Everybody got kicked out and, you know, started working at home. And then Discovery took over because they bought Warner Brothers. And
right.
It went downhill from there.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard a lot of bad stories with the Discovery merger. So,
oh, it was awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was awful because they, I was told this by one of the vice presidents of Cartoon Network, that Discovery did not want to have two studios. So they were going to eventually just get rid of Cartoon Network. And what's left of Cartoon Network is now in the brand new Warner Brothers animation building over in Burbank.
Right.
Near the old NBC studios. And just, nothing left. And I saw a report on the news this morning about how bad Discovery's doing.
Yeah.
Discovery's, when they took over one of us, the stock was like at $25 a share. Mm-hmm. It went down to 18, and this morning it's at $8. So they're going down the toilet. And they just settled up with Don Lemon, who they fired at CNN.
Right.
And he had a contract, and they have to pay him $24 million.
Oh, wow.
So, They're not doing too well, and
right.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, I only hope that if it gets worse, that some of the executives get bounced out. So I'd like to see some of those. I won't name names here, but I'd like to see some of the executives get their ass kicked out of the studio.
Well, I had a long talk with somebody about HBO Max, which is, I guess, it's a unit of Time.
Yeah, it's all
Warner Discovery.
Discovery Warners.
Yeah. And people were plenty pissed off that they took off, you know, they were removing all these Looney Tune cartoons off of there.
Yeah.
But now I heard that they're putting some Looney Tunes back on. They're removing some, putting some back on. And yeah, it's kind of crazy. But
that doesn't make any sense because they own that library.
Yeah.
Because they inherited what, when they bought that, they inherited the stuff that Turner bought way back when, because Turner had bought the Warner stuff and the MGM stuff.
Right.
So they had all that stuff. So why would you get, you know, it doesn't cost you anything.
Right.
Run the damn stuff. So I think the powers that be at Discovery have a lot to be taught. Or I don't think they're the smartest people on the planet. And I think they've made a lot of dumb moves. And
yeah, I mean,
at this point, I don't really care what happens.
Right. Turner Classic Movies. I don't know if you remember that fiasco. And that was all part of that. Yeah.
And mark my words, you know, they I think they got frightened by Spielberg and his pals who talked them out of like getting rid. But I would not be surprised at sometime in the future, because they're cash strapped, if they decide, OK, we're just going to stop Turner Classic Movies and sell off some of that those properties, you know, those films and make some money. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Right. Well, today's day and age, could happen. I mean, it's been happening. It's been happening.
It's the guy who's in charge of Discovery. He's not the brightest guy on the planet. And he's like a disaster, because they also, like a month or so ago, I was reading about how they're talking about merging with Paramount. And I'm thinking, OK, merge with Paramount. And here's what I can tell you. People at Paramount, get ready to get your ass kicked out the door, because that means they'll cut jobs. Anytime you have a merger, people get laid off.
Yeah, people get kicked out. Sometimes good people. Yeah. Sometimes it's just about salaries. You know, you're making too much money. We got to get rid of you. You know?
You know, it's you know, even Disney's cut way back. You know, like Iger put in this thing about we're going to cut 7,000 jobs. So, you know, things are like Disney TV Animation. I have a friend that works on a show over there. And he told me that the show that he's doing now is practically just going into post and won't air until June. And they won't know until sometime after that, I think, if they're going to get a second season. Now, the crew's gone.
Right.
And it's because, you know, they're cutting back.
Yeah.
They're not doing as much as they used to do. All the big studios are cutting back.
It's hard to reassemble a crew to do the same thing. And it's been, you know, you see it over time. You see it, you know, like Hanna-Barbera doing the Tom and Jerry's. You know, MGM cut that unit. All these guys went to Hanna-Barbera to work on stuff. Then they decide, well, we want more Tom and Jerry's. Couldn't find anybody, not even Chuck Jones, to revive that series and make it what it was. You know, even with the template being there, even with those years of all these great Tom and Jerry cartoons, he couldn't match them. He couldn't match them. And they couldn't get the original people back, so they couldn't get the same flavor. It's never been duplicated.
It happens all the time, especially when you revive a show or characters or something like that. What I've always noticed is when a show gets revived nowadays, it's whoever's doing the revival that they have to put their stink on the project. So it's never the same. It doesn't look as good. It's never as done as well.
I like that term, stink. They put their stink on it.
There's a good example of that. Years ago, when Warner Brothers was still in Sherman Oaks, I was talking to a friend of mine. I won't mention his name. And he was producing at Warner Brothers, and I was talking to him on the phone, and he said, "Yeah, we're developing Top Cat." And I said to him, "What's to develop?" It's like, what do you have to develop?
Right.
And thankfully, they didn't do the show, because if they had, a lot of the original voices were dead, so it wouldn't have sound, and they would never have been able to capture that look. They would have made it look whatever the hell. Let's say if it was in the 90s or the 2000s, it would have looked like whatever the crap was that Warner Brothers was doing at that time.
Yeah.
And that's the problem when shows get revived. I mean, DreamWorks did the same thing with the Jay Ward stuff. They didn't try to make it look like the original stuff. They put their stink on it and they made it look like what they wanted to look.
Right.
It happens over and over again. I'll be shocked if anybody ever takes a show that was really a classic show that was well received and liked and bring it back and try to ape it exactly. It never will happen.
No. You worked on the Jetsons, right? The revival?
Terrible stuff.
Yeah. Because they added a character to it. What was it? I don't even remember the... It was,
That stupid little furry character. It's typical. It's like, hey, let's put a dog in the show. So they put in this little alien character. That's probably was a joke. Concept or one of his stooge writers coming up with that, but it happens all the time. And plus the fact they did the first couple of them in-house, and then the rest got sent to Cuckoo's Nest in Taiwan.
Right.
You can never capture the look of, you know, you got to remember the Jetson show was inked. They weren't Xerox. It was inked, and it was all done in-house at Hanna-Barbera. But the guys that were veteran animators from the 30s and 40s had been around for a long time, and that's why it looked the way it did.
Sure. Plus, it was excellent. It was drawn well. It was drawn really well. Yeah.
Animated well, and it was, you know, the Jetsons, Top Cat, and the first couple of seasons of Flintstones were done by those guys.
Yeah.
And you know, Johnny Quest, same thing.
Yep.
You can't recapture that look anymore because it's not drawn the same way, and everybody always changes it. So
yeah, that was wonderful, really wonderful stuff that was being done back then. And I mean, I would even say, like, you know, in the 70s, the stuff was being, it was being produced maybe in the early 70s. It was pretty well drawn for, you know, television animation. Then I think when the stuff just started being sent overseas to be animated, I think that was a problem. Well, I think Smurfs was pretty consistent, though. I think Smurfs looked pretty good.
But surprisingly, I think the overseas studios got better than what was being done in the 70s and 80s at Hanna-Barbera, because the Smurfs eventually got sent to Taiwan, and we were just doing pre and post. So we were directing them here, storyboard directing them, and then they were doing the big labor. And I think they actually did a better job. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot with shows that were sent overseas, because it just depends on where you send them and how much money. For example, the work that was done in the 80s when Disney TV started up, they were sending that to TMS in Tokyo.
Right.
And they were spending good money on it. And that's why those shows look good, because they sent them to a better studio.
Right. TMS was an excellent studio.
Yeah, they did great work.
You know,
and
I just want to bring this up. Like, Jerry Reese did the Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah.
And that thing was animated in Taiwan. I believe it was animated in Taiwan. You know, even though there were animators from here working on it, they had animators over there working on it as well. And they had people cleaning it up. And it just, you know, they didn't have a lot of money. I know they didn't have a tremendous amount of money, but they made it look good. It looked feature quality, what they were doing. So, you know, they were doing pretty good work over there. They've given a little bit more money, you know.
It really depends upon how much money you've got and where things get done. Because, like, if you look at some things were still being done fully here, you know, like, for example, the first Family Dog thing for Amazing Stories. Well, it looks good because it was well-directed, well-drawn, well-animated, and all that stuff. And they probably had a really good budget.
Right.
And same could be said for stuff that was sent early on to Cuckoo's Nest and or Phil Cartoons. Because they always had American supervisors there.
Right.
They could answer questions and fix and change stuff. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist any longer. And, you know, now it's just like digitally send the work, digitally get it sent back and all that. And, you know, I can't think of a show. I don't watch any of the new stuff at all. I don't watch. If I watch animation, which I do a lot, but I don't watch anything new. I watch vintage stuff because that's what I think is really worth watching.
Right. I agree.
So, when I occasionally catch something, if I'm turning the channels and I catch something that's recent, I'm always disappointed because a lot of it looks the same to me.
Yeah.
It has this same style as if it was like done, all of them were done at the same damn place. And I don't find it interesting. But if you have enough money, you can get a great looking show done somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's all about money.
Right. It's always about the money.
I mean, look at, you know, Gendy's work on Primal.
Mm-hmm.
That's animated in France.
Right.
And it's damn good looking.
Yeah.
Because first off, you have great art direction on it. Good storyboards, because I've seen the boards.
Mm-hmm.
Gendy happens to be a really top-notch animator if he wants to animate something. And he's a great director.
Right.
So you have quality people, and they've obviously given him enough money to get it done right, especially if it's going to France. So they have to be spending more money than it was going to than Korea.
Sure.
So it can be done. It just depends upon who's in charge and how much money they want to spend. But most of the stuff nowadays, to me, is like not enjoyable. Let's put it that way.
That was actually going to be my next question. Do you like the stuff that's being done today over the stuff that was being done 20, 30, 40 years ago? And you answered my question.
I like older stuff. I mean, I would rather watch this Jay Ward stuff that was done in Mexico, because it's bad, and it's so bad that it's good.
Right.
And you look at it and you go, hey, this stuff is great. And I'll give another example. Roger Ramjet.
Oh, great.
Roger Ramjet was great because it was low budget, and they had a cell count. You could not go over that number of cells.
Right.
So you had to really think about what you were doing. And that's why the damn show looked so good.
Yeah.
Because they really limited. And they had great, great writing
mm-hmm.
and really good design. So I would rather watch stuff like that than some new show.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, those Ramjet cartoons, they're silly and they're fun. The drawings are fun. The whole thing, and it looks like it's produced on a shoestring, but
it was.
But that goes to show you how good you can make stuff with not too much money, just good ideas. I think the thing that opened up my eyes was South Park, which was, we're talking years ago when that thing came out,
right?
And it was, I think the show was produced in a week, which I don't know how it could be produced in a week, but it looks like it was produced in a week. And they were able to add stuff right up until like showtime when that thing was coming out. And yeah. It was just all about the ideas, and it was all about the funny, and it wasn't about doing fantastic animation. It was just about doing enough to put it across, and
well,
it worked.
That originally started out as a Christmas card thing.
For George Clooney.
If you ever saw the pilot.
Yeah.
And it was cutouts. It was before they did it digitally.
Right.
And that show is all in the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You take away those writers and no one's going to watch that show because it won't be funny.
Right.
And that's what makes the show successful. If it gets down to money, like I know the Simpsons will change things because they have money. They have deep pockets.
Right.
I don't watch any of those shows. I stopped watching the Simpsons 100 years ago. And but they have deep pockets. And the Simpsons does detailed, thorough layouts.
Right.
Because I've seen them. They practically animate the show here.
Yeah.
But deep pockets. And, you know, and they obviously have good writers and all that. And, you know, but most shows are not done that way.
Right.
And especially the non-primetime shows are not done that way.
What's the most favorite show that you've worked on?
Well, the answer to that is easy for me. I always say... probably the favorite show was Samurai Jack because it was so well done.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed working on that show a lot. But I also liked working on Powerpuff Girls, Cow and Chicken, Dexter's Lab, and then going past that, like regular show. I had a good time working on regular show.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite was Samurai Jack because I think it's a really top-notch show. It's great from top to bottom,
right?
And it's just so well done. And so I always say that's my favorite.
Robert, do you have any projects that I know you're retired, and you seem too young to retire? Is there like a project you'd want to do just on your own? Because the computer technology is there. Right. I mean, you don't have to do anything else because you've done a lot of great things over your career. You know, I'm sure, you know, everybody has this personal project that they would just love to work on, even if it was a 2 minute piece or a 5 minute piece or whatever. I don't know if you have that, but.
Well, first off, I'm older than you think. I'm 76 now.
Wow.
And
that's not old.
I feel every moment of it.
Right.
And sometimes I get ideas mm-hmm. in my head for things like I would like to, but then I talk myself out of it. I go like, what am I going to do with that? And because I might think of an idea and I go, I could make a storyboard for this idea. And then I go, well, yeah, but then what? Mm-hmm. And so I'm just not motivated anymore to do anything like I did when I was back at Hanna-Barbera when I was creating those three shorts and the two that I got to produce.
Right.
And the stuff seemed to just flow out. I don't know. It's just like, it's hard for me now to get motivated to do something, even if I have these ideas floating around in my head.
Right.
And actually do them. And if I created something, like if I did a storyboard or something, I know it won't go past the storyboard stage because I don't have the desire to sit and make a cartoon anymore. What would I do with something anyways, if I came up with an idea? It's like, I know what the business is like now. It's like, it would just be for me to do for myself. And
right.
I don't but this could all change next week, next month or next year. And I could go like, hey, I got a great idea and I'm going to fall through, but right. I wouldn't put money on it. I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, you don't have to. I mean, you have this body of work that you've done, and it's you got some wonderful things in there. So you don't have to. Some people have that, though. Some people just have, I got to do one more. I got to do this. Or
you know, yeah. I know that. I've talked to people in the past when they said, well, when I retire, you know, I'm going to do my own films. I'm thinking, yeah, sure. You know, or I'll believe that when I see it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the other thing is like, and everybody's different, but I don't have the energy that I used to have when I was younger.
Sure.
So I don't have that drive and desire to sit down and go, wow, well, I'm going to crank this thing out and I'm going to do it. It's not in me anymore.
Right.
Because, you know, I've been there, done that. I've done it all.
You have done it all.
And I've worked on a lot of stuff. I've done everything. I was an animator. I've done layouts. I've done storyboards. I did my own two shorts. I've directed on a lot of shows.
Yeah.
So there isn't anything in the business that I haven't done.
Right.
And I don't have to prove it myself to anybody anymore.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't see myself creating anything.
Right.
As far as animation goes.
Robert, I just want to thank you for coming on here. I know we have a lot of people here out there that are interested in hearing you, and I appreciate the time. Like I said, we had a technical glitch before, which ate up about 40 some odd minutes of our time, and then basically got back into this. So I appreciate you doing that and hanging on. So
I would tell anybody that listens to your podcast that if they're interested in looking at animation art, mostly vintage stuff, they can find me on Facebook because I'm constantly posting stuff that I've accumulated over the years. And if they like looking at old animation art, that's the place to go.
Well, it's a lot of fun. I've been looking at it and I've been marveling at some of the stuff you have, because a lot of this stuff I thought was just lost to time. You know, you don't see a lot of this stuff anymore unless you go into an animation art gallery and sometimes getting a catalog from an animation auction. But even the stuff that you're posting, I haven't seen a whole lot of it. There's not a whole lot of Alvin and Chipmunk stuff out there or any of that UPA stuff, any of that original UPA stuff that you've been putting up. So, you know, thank you for doing that. Really appreciate
it. Well, I enjoy seeing it and I like posting it because I assume that there's always somebody that's looking at it and going, oh, that's great. And I like looking at them. You know, I'm posting it for that one individual, whoever that person might be, that will enjoy seeing the stuff.
I guarantee you it's more than one. So.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Anyway, I want you to stay well. I want you to, you know, I hope you know, you keep on doing that. And thank you so much for doing this interview. So.
Well, thank you for asking.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Hey, that was a wonderful interview with Mr. Alvarez. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too. I want to thank Tony DiStefano. He recommended having Robert on the show. It was a great choice. So thank you, Tony, for that recommendation. You know, if you have an idea for a guest, yes, you, if you have an idea for a guest and you'd like to hear them on the Cartoonerific podcast, please send a note to me at brian@cartoonerific.com. And I will spell that out because some people misspell Brian. They may spell it in all different ways, B-R-A-I-N, which is actually brain, or B-R-Y-A-N, and some people will add a T to that sometimes. No, it is Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at Cartoonerific, C-A-R-T-O-O-N-E-R-I-F-I-C.com. No exclamation point on there, just Brian@cartoonerific.com. And I will look at it and I'll see what I can do. If you have any other comments, you could put it in there too. And always welcome good stuff. Constructive stuff is always good. Hate mail, not so much. Anyway, next week on the old Cartoonerific podcast, and I can't even get out through my lips, cartoonerific.com is the site, and the Cartoonerific podcast is the name of the show. Anyway, Jerry Beck will be on, and he'll be talking about, well, let's see if you can guess it. Yes, animated cartoons. He'll be talking about animated cartoons. Jerry is a historian. He is an animation buff. He is an author. And he is very knowledgeable. He's a person that's championed animation since the early, the late 70s, I would say. He's so important to this medium. He will be on next week, and we're going to have a nice chat with him. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. Go to your favorite service. Hit the subscribe button. You'll be notified every time a brand new Cartoonerific podcast is uploaded for your enjoyment. And please, please tell a friend about us. Anyway, have a great day. Have an excellent week. And we'll see you all again next time.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.